Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I'm Janie Lee Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quit lit authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to Alcohol Free Life. And I just want to say a really big thanks to all the new listeners who've come on board with the podcast and given me a 5-star rating on iTunes and left a little review. Thank you. Honestly, it just means so much. I just really appreciate it. And I hope that you enjoyed the interview with Claire Pooley. She's such a lovely person. And thank you, Claire, if you're listening, for sharing the podcast as well across your social media. Because, you know, when you've done something new and you've created something new, it's just great when everyone else gives you a bit of a shout out, standing on the shoulders of giants and all that. And thank you to Laura from Club Soda, who interviewed me on the webinar for Club Soda Together. And this show is just rocking because my guest is the awesome Catherine Gray, author of The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober. Now, I've mentioned that book several times already. I'm only a few podcasts in. But it really is such an important book. If you haven't read it yet, just get yourself a copy. It's a fabulous mix of memoir and tips and advice. Before we get into that interview, though, I want to tell you what happened a little while ago. I went with Laura from Club Soda to the Professional Kitchen and Food Service Show in Birmingham. And I was hosting this panel that Laura had set up called Ditch the Orange Juice. And it was really great to be able to be involved in it, because Laura is a big campaigner for the service industry, for pubs and clubs, to change their thinking around the fact that they have such a limited choice, usually, of alcohol-free drinks. You know, I've mentioned before, I'm sure, that one of the first social occasions I went to when I wasn't drinking was a big awards ceremony, and there was literally, you know, champagne, wine, red or white, and for the non-drinkers it was a jug of concentrated orange juice, which I certainly didn't want. So it's brilliant that Laura is doing this work. And on the panel we had Adam from Jar Kombucha, Ambra from the charity Nesta, and Laura, of course. And we had a really good discussion on the importance of equality. And, you know, one of the things we were discussing was that it was only a few years ago that veganism, you know, wasn't huge. And, you know, you wouldn't always get a vegan option on the menu if you went to a restaurant or if you went to a function. But now it's considered, you know, absolutely the norm. It's a dietary requirement. And, you know, you'd be shocked if there wasn't a vegan option. And surely it should be the same, because people choose not to drink for a whole variety of reasons. They might be pregnant or breastfeeding or driving, or it might be for religious reasons. Interestingly, Laura said that caterers who have embraced really good grown-up alcohol-free alternatives have actually found overall that people want to drink more of them. And then, of course, if you think in terms of economy, you know, lots of people drink tap water in restaurants, and you know, how much more money could they be making if they had a decent alcohol-free alternative? So it was an interesting discussion. I also raised the point that there are so many celebs now that don't drink alcohol, and you know, if you were hosting a function and you knew that Bradley Cooper was attending, or Zoe Ball, or Kate Moss, or Kim Catterall, or Eminem, or Davina McCall, that'd be some kind of event, wouldn't it? You wouldn't think of offering glasses of champagne and wine to the other guests and then asking the celebs to go pour themselves a warm, concentrated orange juice. So anyway, Club Soda have actually got a guide now, the Club Soda Guide, where venues get a rating out of 10. So, you know, you never know. They're just might at some point be some change. So let's get to the main bit of this podcast and my chat with Catherine Gray. We met in the West End after she'd been a guest on the BBC show that I work on. She was promoting the new book, The Unexpected Joy of Being Single, on that interview. So you're going to have to forgive the noisy background. It isn't too bad, but we get, you know, interrupted a little bit. There's a little bit of background noise, but hopefully it won't spoil your enjoyment of listening to Catherine. Here we go. Enjoy. So we're in a cafe in the West End overlooking London, and absolutely thrilled that my guest is Catherine Gray, author of The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober and the new book, The Unexpected Joy of Being Single, which I have in front of me. Looks great. Catherine, just for anyone who hasn't read the book yet,
just recap a little bit on your story, because you were one of the people who had a proper rock bottom experience, didn't you?
I did indeed. So when I was in my late 20s, I started trying to moderate my drinking, and this turned out to be completely unsuccessful. And then from the age of 30,
I don't know what that ringing bell is, by the way. I'm not sure, but we'll
anyway,
ignore
we'll,
it. Carry on.
We'll plug on. And then at the age of 30, I went through a really horrendous breakup, and that's when I started drinking alone, and just drinking more and more. And I was finding that even a bottle of wine wasn't sating my urge. I was going back to the shop and getting more. And this grew and grew and grew, and then I ended up in this toxic relationship, and I was drinking alone a lot. I'd stopped going out, I started just staying in, because then I could drink as much as I wanted, and going out had become quite scary because I didn't know what was going to happen. I remember once I found myself in a train station, and I'd been blacked out, and I sort of came to consciousness, and I was near the tracks, and I was like, oh my gosh, I could have fallen on the tracks. And so I became physically addicted. I started getting the shakes and all that sort of thing, and I was, you know, drinking in the morning, and I had hundreds of rock bottoms, really, but one of them was being arrested for being drunk and disorderly when I was 27 in Brixton, which was a real low point, and waking up in a police cell and being like, what the hell just happened? And not remembering anything as to why I was arrested. And then there's lots of times where just my actions were not mirroring how I wanted to behave. I was behaving like a real bitch. And my friends would tell me that I'd called them names when I was drunk, and I just did not remember that or think that about them. And then it grew and grew and grew, and I was just severely depressed, and I was researching suicide, and that was the point where I decided to reach out and ask for help.
I mean, there'll be a lot of people listening who kind of think, when they first hear that kind of story, oh, thank goodness I'm not as bad as that. Oh, thank goodness for that, you know.
I've never been arrested.
I've never been arrested. And there is this, you know, one thing you learn is that there is this spectrum, isn't there? You can be rock bottom, of course you can be even lower than you were, as you've already started to suggest. Or you might be right at the other end of the spectrum. There are all these different shades along the way. But one thing that I think is really important is, as you've already touched on, you're only going to go kind of downhill. And this concept that alcohol is addictive, actually, surprisingly, I don't think I realised that it was only ever downhill. And I don't think I realised how much of a depressant it is.
Yeah, it really is. And I thought that it was helping my anxiety, and now I have so much more confidence. It had become a confidence crutch, and it was taking away my natural confidence. I was beginning to rely entirely on the alcohol to give me confidence, and now I've learned to create that real confidence that means that I can go and do things like be on the radio or whatever.
Yeah, there's the bells ringing just for you. The bells.
We're not outside Big Ben.
I think what it is, every time they serve, they've got someone's tea to bring out. They're ringing the bells. I think so, I'm guessing.
Well, anyway, it's all very British. So you're absolutely right. It's a spectrum. And because I thought you don't quit drinking unless you're at the end of the spectrum, I think we're taught that by films and stories. Yeah. And, you know, you don't quit drinking unless you wake up in a skip. Then I didn't even attempt to quit before I got right to the end of the spectrum. You know, I would say I was an 8 or a 9. But if I'd known, I could have been so much happier sober, and that sobriety wouldn't have been rubbish, then I would have quit when I was 5 or 6.
Absolutely.
You know, and I wouldn't have gone through those years of hell. I would have shaved off the last 3 years of absolute torment.
Yeah.
So I think it's really good that message is getting out there now, that you don't have to be class yourself as an alcoholic to quit drinking, and also you don't have to be an alcoholic to find that you're a lot happier without drinking.
Totally. I think that's the absolute key, and for me that was what made the difference, because I think the really interesting thing is, and I think it's changing, but I think for many people they don't realise that there are loads and loads of other people feeling just like they are, feeling trapped, waking up at 3 a.m, you know, disliking themselves. They know that there's something going down, but they can't think of any possible solution, because the only solution that they can even think about is admitting they're an alcoholic and going to AA, which doesn't ring true at all. Yeah. Certainly didn't for me. You know, I don't feel powerless. I've never felt powerless. You know, don't want to be in that position of feeling that I can't be empowered. So, it reading a book like yours is what made such a massive difference for someone like me, and I'm sure for many other people, because suddenly you weren't just talking about the misery of it all and being rock bottom. Your title is so brilliant. It literally is an unexpected joy that you can find in being sober.
Yeah.
So let's just talk for a minute about this whole thing of when people often begin, when they try to give up, because most people give it a shot a few times, they try and moderate, don't they, often. Most people have had a few goes at it. And the overriding thing in their mind, I think, is this feeling that they ought to stop.
Yeah.
They should, I must, you know, it's doing me harm, I must do it. But actually the subconscious mind is thinking, well, I'm not that bad, I'll just carry on.
Yeah.
So presumably this is where you got to when, I mean, at what point did you realise that, hold on a minute, I'm not just doing this so that I'm not in a prison cell.
Yeah.
I'm doing it because it's better.
Yeah. Well, I think I actually only realised that once I was a couple of months in, maybe. I mean, I started feeling much, much better a couple of weeks in, but we've already talked about the first few weeks is savage. It's really hard. And then you start to feel just so much happier. I mean, it's just obvious, isn't it? It's a depressant, so without it, you're happier. Mm. But nobody had told me this is what you're going to get. You're going to be so much... Everything in your life is going to improve. It was more the you're addicted, so you have to quit narrative.
Yeah.
You have to. And nobody actually has to quit. Everyone just chooses to quit. Mm. So I think if you give that agency back to yourself, and I don't think there is anything as how can you be powerless over drinking if you don't drink anymore. Mm. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
I understand the concept of being powerless once you start, but even then, I had an accidental drink about 3 years ago, and it was only about a fifth of a shot.
What, you mean someone poured you some and you didn't realise?
Yeah,
right.
I ordered a tonic and he gave me a vodka tonic. And I took a slurp out of it and I realised immediately. Mm. And I'd only had, you know, a quarter, a fifth of a shot, but I felt it instantly. And this, going by the thinking whereby I'm powerless, surely I would have downed that drink.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I was like, I hate this.
It's abhorrent.
Took it back to the bar and changed it because I didn't like that feeling anymore. So I think it's really important to shift that thinking, that you choose it, you can choose to be sober, and it can be such a joyful experience. It's all about perception rather than denial that you're gaining something, and you do gain so much from it.
You eat your scone, have a little munch of your scone, and I'll ask you something else. I think you know, you chart beautifully in the book. You know, you've got it's a very detailed memoir, and you chart how tough it is at the beginning. Because I think, you know, on the one hand, we want to share with everybody how amazing this life is, but on the other hand, you do have to be really kind of honest, because at the beginning it's hard.
Yeah.
And both of us, I know we've discussed this separately, privately, didn't tell anybody at the beginning, or we kept it really very secret. I mean, I didn't even tell my family.
Mm.
I just, you know, they're in a world of their own. They get on with what they do. They didn't even notice. Why is it that we feel this sense of shame about what actually is a really amazing decision that we've made? Because you were the same. Mm. You didn't really share it.
Yeah, I mean, only my very closest family knew. And I told my friends very, very reluctantly, only when I saw them. And I think it's because we're told that, we're told that alcohol is only an addictive substance to a rare few, which is not true. It's addictive for everyone who drinks. And it is a downward slope for most people. And B, it's implied that it's a character flaw. It's your lack of willpower that you can't get control over it. Whereas with other addictive substances like smoking, we just see it as obvious. Like if you start smoking, you will eventually go from 3 a day to 10 a day to 20 a day. That's just obvious because it's an addictive substance and we recognise it as such. Whereas with drinking, it's wrapped up in character and whether you're strong enough, and it's just not true.
Yeah.
You know, all you have to do is look at the fact that doctors are twice as likely to become addicted to alcohol, and you know, they're obviously very intellectual people. They know about the health harm that drinking does, and yet, you know, you can't outthink addiction. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know in the book you talk about the fact that you were able to identify the addictive voice, you know, and we both read the same book. I read in your book that you'd read this amazing old book. I found it one in a charity shop, and I kind of devoured this fabulous old book. Jack Trempe, is it?
Yeah.
Rational
Recovery.
Rational Recovery, yeah. And I'm amazed that's not better known, because it's absolute common sense. It's like reading an NLP book now, you know. This is all about mindset. So how did you sort of put that into practice? You chose to kind of visualise or to really make real this voice in your head. Because I know I used to have that voice in my head.
Yeah.
And the voice used to say to me, go on, have another glass of wine, even though you've already had three. Mm-hmm. And I remember actually talking back to myself and saying, actually, I really don't want another one. But the voice was so strong. I used to go and see therapists, and I used to say, you know, I know it sounds a bit weird, but I've kind of got this voice that talks to me. And I remember one you know, really, you know, a complete kooky, amazing guru type telling me that maybe I had a kind of, you know, an entity. You know, certainly had a spirit.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why they call it spirit. So I went away thinking, oh, my God, I'm possessed. You know, why didn't she just say to me, sweetie, you're drinking too much?
Yeah,
why don't
normal.
You quit?
Yeah.
It's bizarre. Anyway, my question was, how did you kind of get to grips with this? Just explain what you think the addictive voice is.
Okay.
And how you got to grips with it.
Okay, cool. So I discovered, so actually this was just before my final day one, I discovered this blog called, and you've had her on, I know, Belle.
I'm
Tired of Thinking About Drinking, and she talks about her addictive voice as Wolfie, and then I was led to addictive voice recognition, which she actually wasn't aware of. She just named her voice accidentally.
Oh, wow.
and didn't know about this technique.
Oh, really?
That was devised in the 50s by Jack Trimpey. And like you, I had this voice, and it tried all sorts of different tactics to get me to drink. It would try putting me down, saying, you're a loser, you may as well have a drink. It would try saying that I'm going to fail eventually, you'll eventually have a drink, so you may as well have one now. It would try, if I was alone in the house, it would say, well, nobody's here, nobody will know. You know, it tried every different possible avenue to get me closer to a drink. And so it made absolute sense to me, naming this voice and making it into a character, because that's not actually what I wanted to do. I didn't want to drink anymore, and yet this voice did want me to. So I called mine Voldemort, like Harry Potter, like the villain. And that's what what he felt like, which was very persuasive but evil. And it really worked, because it separated out that that desire to drink from my true self, which didn't want to drink anymore.
So it's a really good tip for people, actually, isn't it, to try and come up with a character or visualise that other bit of them that they really actually don't recognise.
Definitely.
Tell us about the early stages then. Tell us about some of the things that you found helpful. Obviously, as you say, naming that voice. Were you the kind of person who kind of holed up and just went to bed early and avoided social occasions, or did you sort of kind of throw yourself out there?
I would say definitely within the first few weeks I was in hibernation mode, but then it was actually quite important to me that I not avoid pubs or gigs or things like that. So I always tried to go, but I always gave myself permission to leave when I needed to. And actually, there was only one time when I had to leave somewhere, and that was because I was in a restaurant, and I was only about 5 or 6 weeks, and the stench of the booze was overpowering, and the people I was with were drinking, and I just started having a panic attack, and so I had to leave. But my friends absolutely understood, and that was the only time I had to do that. So if you give yourself permission to go if you need to, then I think that's a good idea. You don't have to avoid places that serve alcohol. Like, we're in one right now. Because you just don't want it anymore. The more that time goes on, it's just like smoking. It's just like quitting smoking. You want it at the beginning, and that lessens and lessens over time, and then after a while, it becomes repulsive, and you can't imagine why you ever did that. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's really important to stress that, actually, because at the beginning, it's hard to imagine that's true.
Mm.
It is. It really is. So, for people who are right at the beginning and thinking, but I don't want to give up, I'm going to moderate. What's your experience of moderation? Do you think that mindful drinking, as it's termed now, can work for some?
Yeah, I think it can work for some. Not me, that's for sure. Whenever I had one or two drinks, that just annoyed me. I was just annoyed. I mean, I could do it, and there was a handful of times when I did do it, but I didn't want that. I wanted to get drunk. And I tried every tactic in the book. I read around it loads and did everything I could find to try and nail moderation. But I think if you're consistently drinking more than you intend to, then you're one of these people that are unable to moderate. And that's actually most of us.
Yeah, so, absolutely. You don't have an off switch.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean that you're a failure in any way, because that is how most of British people drink.
Yeah.
The Lancet report last August found that British people on average drink 26 units a week, which is absolutely not moderation. That's well above the 14 unit threshold. So we as a nation are collectively failing to moderate. So it's really important that people know that. It's not that they're broken, it's that everyone's pretty much failing at this.
Yeah, well, it's so ingrained in every aspect of our culture, isn't it?
Yeah, so if moderation is one or two drinks, when I go out with my friends, they never drink one or two drinks.
No, of course.
They just don't. So it's really hard to moderate. Alcohol is Moorish. You have more than one or two.
So let's talk about the whole thing of kind of becoming a different person, because I think that's one of the things, again, that I don't think I'd expected. The first few months really feel like a roller coaster, and you do feel, I think, most people feel quite raw. They're kind of uncovering a new version of themselves. And I love the analogy in your book where you refer to the little Russian dolls, and you've got the little painted one on the outside, and that's the one you've got to know, gets on the table and dances at parties or whatever, but actually you then start uncovering the other dolls underneath. And it's not without its pain sometimes, because presumably one of the reasons that most of us drink is because we do want to numb out some of those feelings. So when there isn't the drink there, we do have to face stuff.
Tell
us how that kind of panned out for you, and if you've got any tips for people who are getting to that point of, oh, wait a minute, I'm not sure who I am anymore.
Well, I think I had absolutely become the party girl persona, because I'd never gone to a party and not drank, and I normally drank before the party as well, and so I was behaving like an extrovert when I'm not. I'm an introvert. And I remember when I was about 6 weeks sober saying to one of my best mates, I think I'm an introvert, and she literally laughed so hard she sprayed tea over me, because she was like, no, you're not. Like, you are not. You're a party girl. And I wasn't. That's what I discovered. I wasn't the person who wanted to be the centre of attention and wanted to wear a little dress and parade around a party. That's just not who I am at all. And so, in a way, it was like going back to who I was when I was 12 or 13, when I started drinking, which was quite shy. Loves nothing more than curling up with a dog and a book, and not really, my natural habitat is not lots of people and lots of noise. It's one-on-one or small groups, and I can go and enjoy a party, of course I can. And I can go and dance now, but I would never choose to do that on a weekly basis. That would be an intermittent thing for me.
But having said all of that, I know you feel that some of the words around sobriety need a bit of a rebrand. We say things like stone cold sober, and which you say should be sunshine warm sober, isn't it? Something like that. Because there is this perception, again, that if you're sober, you are then boring.
Yeah.
Which is, total nonsense. But I think people do feel fearful at the beginning. They think, oh my goodness, well, am I going to become boring? Am I going to become someone who can never go out and have fun again?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought. And we also have sober as a judge, which makes out that you're very judgmental when you're sober, which is absolutely not true, because sober people mostly are absolutely retired hellraisers who have done stuff that you can't even imagine. They're like the retired rock stars. And I really, really did feel like I was boring, you know, when I hadn't had a drink. I took a drink to liven myself up, and I felt like I couldn't tell an anecdote successfully without a drink. But all that was social anxiety. And because I started drinking so young, I'd become reliant on the alcohol. And so I had to relearn. I had to go back to being that teenager and relearn how to go to a party or go to a dinner or whatever and not rely on alcohol to bring out the sort of social side of me. But now I have. I'm much more confident. And actually, it's really interesting when you observe a party, because when people are drinking, they're most fun and most non-boring at the start of the party.
Yes.
So that is really interesting to me, because you think, oh, well, they'll be most fun when they've had more to drink. But no, that's when people...
I read in your book that hilarious tip of when you go to a party, pretend you're David Attenborough.
Yeah.
And you're observing the humans in their natural habitat.
Yeah.
Drinking. I mean, that's hilarious, because you're absolutely right. You start to, you know, you're having a really good chat with someone, and then a couple of hours in, they're slurring their words and telling you exactly the same thing they told you earlier.
Yeah, and then you realise that you were that person.
Exactly.
And then I could remember, so I went to this Boxing Day party this year, and I've been to it many, many years. It's a family party, and people were gravitating towards me, whereas a few years, well, it would have been like 6 or 7 years ago when I was still drinking, I remember noticing that people were avoiding me. They were coming and talking to me because I was so drunk and I wasn't really making any sense.
Yeah.
But I remember having that level of awareness that people didn't want to be around me. And so now that's flipped, because I'm sober and I'm not breathing like fags all over them and repeating myself. So it's completely the opposite. Very drunk people are boring, and sober people are engaging and interesting and funny, and you know, they are the most interesting people at the party. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the book, you get to the good stuff, and you tell us some of the amazing benefits, and I love your list of benefits, because you know it's all the big things that you'd expect, but it's little things. Like, I seem to remember, and you say, I haven't got it in front of me, but I seem to remember you say, I smell nicer.
Yeah.
And loads of little things. I know for me, one of the really small things, but actually it's huge for me, is that I could get my contact lenses in.
Yeah.
You know, of a morning. Like the first time that happened, wow, that's a big deal. I could get my contact lenses in without sort of flirting them across the bathroom and you know, stressing about, because I used to think I was just tired. I wasn't tired. I just had way too much to drink, and your eyes don't like that. You know, who knew? But the other thing in the book is that you're incredibly honest about how you've changed as a person and your relationship with other people. I mean, how did you get to be so brave as to actually ask someone to write about the old Catherine and the new Catherine?
Oh, well, I mean, I was at least 3 years sober when I did that.
Right.
Like, that didn't happen in the first year. But I knew that it would keep me going. It would provide me with sober power kind of thing, because I knew that people liked me a lot more now that I was sober.
So you actually asked a friend who'd known you for a long time what the differences were.
Yeah.
And was that quite surprising for you to read?
Yeah, because there was instances they'd listed in the letters that I did not remember at all. I blanked out where I'd caused great injury to them by being not a very nice person. And so it was hard to read, but very important to read. But I would only advise that once you're further down the line, because in the first 6 months, you're very raw. I wouldn't advise that in the first 6 months.
Yeah.
But once you've got enough distance from the person you used to be, and you're really starting to like the person you're becoming, then that's a good tactic to keep you going.
Sure. Let's talk about some of the stuff that happens in the early months. A lot of people kind of flip from one addiction to another and find that sugar literally calls to them. You know, chocolate bars actually start talking to them. Presumably they need an addictive voice picture as well, don't they?
Yeah.
Or is your view just, you know what, deal with that separately? Just eat the sugar if you have to. What's your take on that?
time, I would say just go with it in the beginning, because as long as you're not drinking, it's fine. Yeah. You know, for the first couple of months, just do whatever you need to stay sober. I remember drinking a whole bottle of full-fat Coke every day and eating loads of Haribo, because there's so much sugar in booze. So yes. My body was withdrawing from that. And if I hadn't have given it the sugar, then it would have been withdrawing from both alcohol and sugar.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, just do one thing at a time, yeah. And then you can look at that later. But cross-addiction is so, so common.
Well, you got addicted to exercise, but that's quite cool. I wish that one had happened to me. Sadly, yeah. It didn't.
Yeah, I went to a stage where I was exercising every day, and I was running like 12 kilometres.
Wow.
But I found that it really got rid of my stress. Thank you.
Georgia tea?
Yeah, could I have a peppermint tea, please? Thank you.
I'm good, thanks.
I'm also a bit addicted to peppermint tea, but anyway. I found that it absolutely, that, you know, the stress that builds up and the anxiety that builds up, it released that. So it was one of my most important tools, and I would recommend it for everybody, even if it's just a walk.
Yeah.
And it's been shown that 10 minutes of exercise nixes an alcohol craving, so it does work.
Yeah.
But be mindful not to become so dependent on it that you need it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I'd say.
Sure. And what about the whole relationships thing? Because I've listened to a lot of podcasts and, you know, done a lot of reading or Quitlet and all the rest of it. And it's not uncommon for relationships to shift and change. And sometimes people find they don't want to be in a relationship with someone anymore, which is quite a big one. You know, and of course, friendships change. And we're going to go on to mention your new book, of course, The Unexpected Joy of Being Single, which I'm sure relates in some way. But how did you find that your relationships were affected?
So with friends or...
Well, I either, yeah.
Okay, well, with friends, at first, I think my very best friend was very relieved that I quit drinking, because she was actually my only friend who was like, yes, great decision.
Oh, great. That's great.
The rest of them, and I think they were trying to comfort me, but also they didn't know how bad it had gotten. They were very much of the, you're not that bad.
Yeah.
Why don't you just try
just
and moderate?
Have one.
Or,
yeah.
Why don't you just have a few months off and then you can start again? You're not that bad that you need to completely quit. And that's one of the things that's so hard about quitting, is that people resist it. Mm. So you're doing this thing that's really hard anyway, and then people are trying to talk you out of it. So, you know, but I think society's shifting in that regard.
Yeah.
So anyway, at first they were a bit confused. They were just like, what is going on? Like, I don't know what to do with Kat. Normally we go and drink wine, so what do we do now? So we had to create new rituals, and some of them, I remember one of them asked me, can you still go to parties? And I was like, yes. And then she invited me to her birthday party. So I don't think people know what to do at first. But all of my... I mean, there's been a couple of drinking buddies that fell by the wayside.
Yeah.
But all of my friendships are still the same and are much, much stronger from quitting.
And then in terms of romantic relationships, I'm guessing that... there must be some link between what was going on at the time and this new book, you know, The Unexpected Joy of Being Single, because I'm guessing that it was while, you know, as you became sober, you suddenly had a lot more clarity on your romantic relationships.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they go hand in hand. Love addiction and alcohol addiction are a horse and carriage.
Do you think you were you did have love addiction?
Yeah,
do you think
definitely.
That's very common?
Yeah, I think it's really common amongst women in particular. And so Holly and Laura of Home podcast, they call it the second sobriety, recovering from love addiction.
Really?
And having a period of dating. And I think that's so true, because it becomes this cycle where you console yourself from breakup with alcohol, and then you use alcohol to meet the new person. And I think you use it to bond with, you know, on dates, and become this sexy person that you want to be. And also, I'd never had sex sober.
Oh, yeah.
I was terrified.
Sober sex, that's a big one.
I just did not know how that was going to happen. I couldn't imagine it. Mm. I couldn't imagine going on a date sober. Like, I just didn't know how I was going to do that. So it took some adjustment, for sure. And then, so I ended up having a whole year off. I had a relationship, a six-month relationship, right in the beginning. And then when that ended, I was really crushed. And I was like, look, I need to take some time out and readjust the perspective that I give romantic relationships, because they're too important.
Yeah.
I need to shrink them.
And that's what's led to this new book. Tell us the premise of the new book, which I think is going to be absolutely huge.
Oh, thank you. So basically it's all about my taking the year off dating and how that completely realigned how I saw relationships. Mm. And I've now been single for almost 3 years, apart from little flings here and there, but nothing that's been like boyfriend and girlfriend. And now I just see a romantic relationship as a choice rather than a necessity, whereas before I think I really thought, I have to meet somebody if I'm going to be happy.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very common thing. And you know, for me, obviously I'm a lot older than you, but I was in the wrong relationship for a good 10 years, probably 12 years. And when I think back, I'm shocked. You know, I'm quite a strong person. I know what I want. But I think the truth is I stayed in that relationship because I was really, really fearful of being on my own.
Yeah.
And it really comes down to that. And I think you're right, so many women do think that. And also our perception as a society, and this is what you talk about in the book, our perception is that someone who is becomes single, we feel sorry for them, even celebrities.
Yeah.
Which is just bizarre, isn't it?
I know. I mean, look at Jennifer Aniston and all the pity that she gets. She is the most fabulous woman on the planet, pretty much. She's just got it all going for her.
She doesn't need someone to fix her, but that's the perception, isn't it? That women need a man to complete who they are.
Yeah, I think that really is. And if they haven't found that, then they've failed in some way. I think that's also a perception. And it's just not true. So we need to move away from that. Mm. I really think we do. And to be teaching our little girls different things. Because at the minute, we're raising them to think that getting married is the ultimate goal.
Do you think we still are? I mean, that seems incredible to be saying that in this day and age.
I know, but I really do think that is still the case. Like when I got my book deal, I got lots of texts and emails and all sorts of lovely things, like a few cards and a couple of presents. But a friend of mine was getting married at the same time and she got deluged, you know. So I think her marriage was seen as a bigger accomplishment than my book deal. Mm. And that really started me questioning as to why that is. And I think it's because we are trained as women to go towards this marriage and babies goal. Mm. And our career is seen as secondary.
And what's your take on relationships that then don't stay together, you know, divorce or separation? Because, again, you know, we've already said that there's a big link here, and that often when people get sober, they can often realise they're in the wrong relationship.
Yeah.
Is that okay in your book?
Yeah. I mean, I did. So I walked away from a relationship I'd lived with him for a year, and we'd been together a year and a half, and I'd stayed in that relationship a year too long.
Yeah.
And when I started sobering up, like when I was putting together 3, 5, 7 days sober, I started seeing it clearly, and that's what gave me the courage to walk away. And I think that's really common. And also because you may have bonded over the fact that you're both heavy drinkers or like a party, then if you quit, then that, you know, well, how does that relationship, it needs to redefine itself. And I do know lots of people who have continued and they've managed to work their way through it, but often, yeah, it is the case that you find yourself moving away.
Yeah. So finally then, what would be your sort of top tips, if you like, for somebody, you know, maybe at the beginning of this journey, or maybe haven't even started yet, but they're thinking, well, I'm going to give it a go?
I would say learn everything you can about it. So listen to all the podcasts, read all the books, because there's that real hunger of knowledge that we talked about earlier.
Immersing yourself in it's really important, isn't it?
Just absolutely, you've got that intrigue, feed it. Mm. Use that curiosity, because that is how you're going to retrain the way you think about it, is by learning.
And I think you also said, maybe it was when I interviewed you for the Mindful Drinking Festival, that you think it's a really good idea to just kind of clear your clutter and get the old alcohol bottles out of the house.
Yeah.
I think that's important, because, you know, you don't want them kind of singing to you in the middle of the night in week one, do you?
Yeah, exactly. I do think it's important, because it just means that, I mean, alcohol is all around us all day. It's in the supermarket. It's at work even.
Yeah.
You know, people start drinking at 3 p.m. on Fridays. It's over there right now. Mm. It's something that it's sort of in your periphery all day long. So when in the first couple of months, it's important to create like a booze-free haven.
Yeah.
And even if that's just where you don't keep your favourite wine, you know, if vodka doesn't talk to you, then don't, it doesn't really matter. but I would say it's important just to give yourself that rest where you can just like collapse and go, oh, I don't know what to think about it now because there's none here.
Yeah. And as you say, just to come back again, having said that, to this concept that, you know, well, it comes back to your amazing title, you know, there is an absolute unexpected joy in being sober that I could never have imagined.
Yeah.
That's what's so wonderful about your book is that you do tell it straight. You know, you did have your complete rock bottoms. It wasn't all beautiful along the way. You know, there were some hard times, but ultimately, this is worth doing.
Yeah,
you know,
is that
really your kind of message? I mean, do you meet people who go through all of this and then they go, nah, I'm going to go back to drinking?
No, nobody does that. And even if they do go back to drinking, they want to get sober again. So that tells you it's worth it. Nobody regrets getting sober. That's the thing. And it is hard, but it's hard in the way that travelling for 6 months is hard. You have days where you're like, I can't do this, I can't get another flight or whatever. I can't carry this backpack, or, you know, saving for a house is really hard, or having kids is really hard.
Anything worth doing, I guess, is really
hard. It's really hard. So it's the same thing, but the rewards far outweigh the toil. That's the point. And it's really hard at the beginning, but then it gets easier and easier and easier until it's effortless. And then you're free for the rest of your life.
Mm. Catherine Gray, thank you so much. I just absolutely love your work. You're totally inspirational. Love it. Author of The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober and the new book, The Unexpected Joy of Being Single. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can eat your scones now.
Yeah, that was so fun. I really enjoyed that.
You're listening to the podcast Alcohol Free Life with Janie Lee Grace, and that was the lovely Catherine Gray. And as you know, I always do a self-care tip. Actually, we were having a lot of self-care right there because we were actually eating scones with jam and cream. There's decadence for you. I don't think I would have ordered that before, but it was Catherine's idea and it was great. And actually, it was quite ironic being at that venue with Catherine, because when I went up to pay, I noticed there was a sign saying discount with the BBC staff card. So I thought, well, I may as well have that discount there. So I whip out my ID card and then they said, oh, no, the discount is only applicable when you buy alcohol. Oh, the irony. So my proper self-care tip this week is to encourage you to write. Now, I know that some of you will have heard the podcast interview with Claire Pooley. And of course, that's how she got started. You know, she anonymously wanted a way of getting her feelings out. So when life felt like a roller coaster, that's when she started the blog Mummy Was a Secret Drinker, and that was her accountability. Now, I'm not suggesting that everyone has to write a blog or has to publish anything they write, but I do think that actually just the art of writing, and I'm going to suggest something very controversial here, you know, like get a pen and paper. Wow, what is even that? But Julia Cameron, who is an amazing author of The Artist's Way, which really ought to be renamed Creativity for Everyone, amazing author, she suggests that writing longhand really is cathartic. And she suggests that we do what she calls morning pages. So when you wake up every single day, you know, grab your tea or your coffee or whatever it is, and just get some bits of paper and stream of consciousness stuff. So just getting out your thoughts onto paper, and you don't edit what you write. This isn't about thinking, oh, how can I construct an interesting sentence? It's just literally get everything out of your head. So it might be as random as, you know, I forgot to buy a birthday card, or I'm really stressed about whatever's coming up, or, you know, it whatever it is. And some people find that this is like almost like a form of meditation, and it works incredibly well for them. They feel calmer, they feel clearer. And if you are a creative type, then this can really help shift some blocks. So it really is just the writing that's very therapeutic. So, you know, I stress again, I'm not saying that everyone has to publish a blog or a book, but just write stuff down. If nothing else, if that doesn't resonate with you, then if nothing else, write a gratitude list before you go to sleep. This is something that you know, many people do. Many sober heroes suggest this, in fact, particularly in the early days. You know, write down 5 to 10 things that you're grateful for, even on the really crappy days. In fact, especially on the crappy days, because then it makes you focus on what is good in your life. And there's always something, right? I've got some great guests lined up, by the way, in the next few weeks. Make sure you don't miss any episodes. I'm going to be speaking with a great personal trainer and self-care expert, Molly Millington. I'm going to definitely try and get the guys from Sober apparel brand Rock Sober. And I'm definitely interviewing Dr. David Hamilton, the author of Why Kindness is Good for You and several other books. Hopefully Andy Ramage will come on the show too from One Year No Beer. There's just so many great experts and quitlet authors and sober heroes in this arena. It's just such an exciting time. It's definitely a trend. I might have to make the podcast daily. No, I'm just kidding. So if you have enjoyed the show, please tell others, please share it and you know, rate it on iTunes. Do the 5-star thing. She says, hopefully, and leave a nice comment. And follow me on Instagram as well. It's at Janie Lee Grace, J-A-N-E-Y. I should spell my own name correctly. And don't forget that I am still, you know, working with the charity My Yard. We've got this little campaign going called Stay Dry Till July. So it's just a hashtag, Stay Dry Till July. And we just want your self-care tips. So what are the little things that work, well, little or big, that work for you? It's not about how much money you can spend, but sometimes it's just those small things that just make you feel better, in addition to not drinking, of course, which is the best self-care tip of all. So yeah, just come on board on Facebook at Janie Lee Grace or Instagram and just use the hashtag Stay Dry Till July. We've got some really cool prizes. We've teamed up with some brands who are just giving away some nice bits and bobs to make the winter feel a bit brighter, really. So check out alcoholfreelife.co.uk as well. There's a few blogs there. And feel free to get in touch. Tell me what works for you. Share your story. You'd be really, really welcome. The email is janie@janieleegrace.com. So don't forget Instagram. Message me there. And on Facebook, it's at Janie Lee Grace Loves for all the kind of holistic recommendations and stuff that I do. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast with Janie Lee Grace. Please subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us, share on social media, and tune in again.